The Europeans are supported by Stackery.
Stackery is the global leader in international parcel forwarding from the United States. Shop at any US retailer and ship anywhere with Stackery.com at prices up to 80% less than directly from the store. Stackery provides free storage, same-day consolidation of your packages, and a tax-free US address.
That's Stackery spelled S-T-A-C-K-R-Y. Save 10% off your first shipment with coupon EUROPEANS.
Please do use that coupon because, frankly, we need the money. Katie lost her laptop on Air France this week. Hello, Europe. This is the Europeans podcast, which you probably already know because you clicked on it, with the Parisian journalist Katie Lee and me, Dominic Kramer, coming to you from Munich this week. And it's been a very German week for our podcast because Katie has also been in Deutschland, haven't you?
Yeah, darling. I have been in the beautiful city of Aachen, not winning any money for this podcast, sadly. But we were nominated for a prize, which is really cool. So,
and actually, it said we won a prize on the certificate, didn't it?
I was going to ask you about this. Do you think we can now call ourselves award-winning podcast, The Europeans?
Yeah, we won the Dutch prize.
Cool. I mean, it's kind of like being nominated for the Eurovision song of your country. You've still won something.
Yeah, well, it's funny you should say that because we are later going to be interviewing a composer, producer slash beatboxer who has written songs for like so many different countries for Eurovision, but only ever got to the national finals and never to the final finals. But I think he's a winner just getting to the national finals. So if we're calling him a winner, then we're winners too.
That seems fair enough. We know we bought you some Eurovision last week, but given that this is like the main cultural event of the European year, and that last week we dealt with something a little bit different, the issue of Eurovision gambling and how to make money on this amazing event, I think it's entirely justified.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think Magica, who we're going to be speaking to, he's the perfect person to debrief this weekend's competition and to kind of ask questions about whether he thinks the competition still has any musical merit, because Katie was pretty shady about it last week. And I think he might push back against that.
Is he going to do the entire interview in beatbox?
I hope so. He's got his own podcast, and at the beginning of each podcast, he beatboxes the name of his guest, which is a much better thing than we've been doing. Why didn't we get onto that, Katie?
Because we've got really low quality microphones and it would sound horrendous.
Oh, nothing to do with the fact that we don't have beatboxing quality either.
Oh, no, that wouldn't be a problem. We could do that.
Okay, go on. Who's our other guest?
Not even gonna try. I mean, so I didn't come back with any money. Like the city of Berlin, we are poor but sexy, won no money, but we did win lots of friends.
Aww.
I know it's cheesy, but it's true. I was in Aachen with really cool young people from every single country within the European Union. It was kind of unexpectedly hilarious. Like, I really wasn't expecting to have such a brilliant time with them. But we really bonded as a group, partly because the second day, it was a 3-day trip, so quite a long time. And the second day, they made us sit through 7 hours of incredibly boring lectures about Europe by all these like really dry old people. And while all this was going on, we were all complaining about it in this WhatsApp group saying like, this is complete bullshit. Why are we doing this? And this is literally why the EU gets such a bad rap, because when people think about the EU, they think about a bunch of old white men sitting in a room saying nothing for hours.
Was this put on for you, for the young people?
No, because we were like, I thought we were here for like a reward and this is really not fun.
It's definitely a punishment.
But it was really funny because eventually the old people got so bored of themselves that they started falling asleep. So we were like surreptitiously taking pictures of them all on our phones and sending them to this WhatsApp group. And it was so funny and everyone was like trying so hard not to laugh that it turned into this amazing bonding experience over like how terrible this event was. And then the rest of the trip was just really cool. Because I didn't win any money, I thought, well, I'm going to make use of the fact that the EU is like paying for basically unlimited beer and waffles. So I just ate tons of waffles and drank loads of beer and had a great time.
Katie, this sounds just like the Bulgarian youth event again. Was there any dancing on tables?
There wasn't any dancing and tables. I did actually meet someone who had been to that event but missed the bit with the naked ladies. And was a little bit disappointed, frankly.
Yeah, what a shame. But didn't you say that a few young people like made a bit of a statement about how boring that day had been publicly?
There was like one moment on that day where they were like, and now let the young people talk. And Verena got up and was just like, yeah, I just want to say how disappointed I am that you didn't try harder to have more diversity at this event, because it was really like just this entire room full of old, white, mostly male people. And it was really depressing. But it was really nice, like within this group of us, it was completely different. You know, like there was a transgender Somali refugee, there was a deaf guy, there were people of all different colors. It really felt like we all had probably a lot more in common amongst ourselves, even though we all speak different languages, than we did with the people that were lecturing us. And it was just this really amazing thing to be in this really cool group of people from 28 countries and all of us like pissing ourselves laughing together. I think that's amazing. I think that's the kind of thing that our grandparents could never have even dreamed of doing. And that is the kind of thing that makes this whole Europe thing worth doing.
Oh, you felt all mushy about Europe again.
I did. What am I turning into?
So did you find some guests for our podcast? Because that's the most important task that I set you.
I did. I interviewed two people actually while I was there, one of which you're going to hear this week. Farah Abdi, the amazing LGBT refugee activist that I mentioned.
Amazing. You also have to talk about the other person you met, the person who you were on television with and in Le Monde. And Katie's been a bit famous this week, guys. You've probably seen her across your European newsstands.
I'm sure you've all seen the selfies because we've plastered them all over social media. Yes, I did indeed meet the man whose screaming face is in our logo, the French president, Emmanuel Macron. Yeah, we had a bit of a moment on stage where we had a selfie together, and he said some kind words to all of us youngsters in Europe, saying like, I'm very proud of you all and well done, keep doing what you're doing. And yeah, it was pretty crazy. That man wears a lot of makeup.
Does he? Mm. They say he pays like someone full time to work for him to do his makeup. So it should look good.
He blended his foundation very well along his jawline, which I think not many people do.
Great. That's very important.
Yeah. So that's my big insight.
But yeah, do check out our Instagram if you haven't, because there are some quite good pictures of Katie with Macron, particularly the one that she found from TV where she's like giving him such a death stare and he's, well, he looks like he's telling a joke. So we are Europeans Podcast on Instagram. Find us there. Did you meet Merkel as well then?
Didn't meet Merkel, saw her speak, which was really cool. I really like Merkel. She comes across as just like really super self-deprecating in person. There was this moment where she was being introduced and the guy introducing her was like, and then Chancellor Merkel is going to do this very big important speech. And Merkel just pulled this little face like, uh-oh, to the side. She's so different in style from Macron, who is very sort of like presidential and I want to really be taken seriously. She's really funny.
And because we didn't win, you listeners all promised that you would leave us reviews on iTunes. So we're really looking forward to reading them.
Yes, please do. I actually reread some of the ones that people have been leaving us recently on the way home because I was a bit sad that we didn't manage to win this prize. And it really made me feel a lot better. So thank you so much for all the amazing reviews that you've been leaving us.
Yay.
Should we get on with this podcast then?
Let's do it, okay. Good week, bad week.
Good week, bad week.
So we were initially thinking that it might have been a good week for Italian populists because at the time of recording, we are inching towards a government in Italy, but still nada. Sorry, that's Spanish, isn't it? What is it in Italian? Niente.
Niente.
So apart from Italian populists, probably, who else has it been a good week for, Dum-Dum?
I would say it's been a pretty good week in Germany because there has been a record fall in the overall crime rates. The crime rate fell by almost 10% to its lowest rate since the early 1990s. And crimes committed by immigrants from outside the EU also dropped sharply. This is obviously good news in and of itself, but it also works to counter the far right's narrative that Germany's acceptance of refugees would lead to greater crime. Merkel's been under a lot of pressure, as everyone knows, for her open door policy of welcoming refugees. Back in 2016, there were lots of far-right protests, particularly the ones in Cologne following this string of sex attacks around New Year's Eve, some of which, but not all of which, were perpetrated by asylum seekers. And there were posters around saying, "Rape fugees not welcome," which is horrible and demonizing, as well as just a terrible pun.
I love that that's what you're getting outraged about.
Yeah. Sorry, it's inappropriate to be outraged about that. But these statistics are a good sign that there isn't a correlation between welcoming people fleeing from war-torn parts of the world and a rise in crime in your country. That said, refugees and asylum seekers are slightly overrepresented in sexual assault cases and violent crimes, although the overall number of sexual assault and rape crimes from suspects of non-German origin have dropped year on year. I mean, it's always possible to try and find whatever narrative you want from these complex figures. And like, for example, if you look into the figures, you can see that anti-Semitic crimes are on the rise. Listen back to our episode from May the 1st to hear more about that from the erudite director of Human Rights Watch Germany. And also religiously motivated crimes are on the rise. However, we have to give good week to somebody, and the headline figure is good. So we thought it was good enough to assign Germany with our position of good week.
I read that even though crime's fallen, there's been like a rise in the number of Germans that have reported feeling unsafe.
Yeah.
So, which is a completely separate phenomenon, but I thought it was kind of interesting.
I think that is interesting. And it's probably partly to do with the political climate and the fact that Alternative for Deutschland have like seized on this idea that Germany is less safe because of welcoming in all these refugees. I'm sure it's not just as simple as that, but...
Yeah, I saw that there was this hashtag going around, Kriminalstatistik, with people saying, oh, it's not true, and... That
was it a French hashtag? Because
no, that was my German accent.
Ah, okay.
How was that not obvious?
Kriminalstatistik.
I've been in Germany all week. Ich bin more or less Deutsch now.
Oh yeah, I can hear that. Who's had a bad week? I think I can guess.
It has been a bad week for Europe's relationship with America. Everything was going so well, Dominic. At the beginning of last week's episode, we were like, yay, peace with North Korea beckons. And then Trump goes and torpedoes the Iranian nuclear deal. And what this means is there are not only going to be new American sanctions on Iran, but also sanctions on international companies that do business with Iran, which includes quite a lot of European companies, particularly French ones, actually, and German ones, like Renault, the car brand, and Airbus, the maker of airplanes. So Europe is really pissed off about all of this. Trump is basically trying to force everyone else in the world to go along with his pretty bad foreign policy decision. I think we can say it's pretty bad. I mean, certainly here in Europe, the one thing that our leaders have been quite united on this week is this idea that the Iranian nuclear deal, which was signed in 2015 in a bid to stop Iran from getting a nuclear bomb, was a really good thing, even if it wasn't perfect.
Yeah, it's one of the few things that like Europe and Russia and China all agreed on.
Literally everyone agrees on it apart from Trump.
But it's funny, I was listening to a bit of Slate's political gabfest a few minutes ago, in fact, and there was a guy from the New York Times who I can't remember who was talking about the fact that like actually this isn't that unusual in American foreign policy for the last few decades. Like America has historically like dropped out of quite a lot of these international treaties that everyone else has agreed on. So yes, it feels more extreme because it's Donald Trump and he always does it in a way that makes it all about him, but it kind of fits a pattern.
In terms of the Trump administration, I think it's going to be this massive signal to Europe that Trump's White House is just not a reliable partner when it comes to trying to fix anything international because you just can't work with them. So yeah, not a great week for European diplomacy. Macron and Merkel and Britain's foreign minister Boris Johnson had all been over to the White House to try and convince Trump that this wasn't a good idea. But still he went ahead. But I think there's like a real impetus in Europe now to carry on trying to make the Iran deal work and stick a middle finger up to Trump. So it's going to be very interesting and a little bit scary to watch what happens next. Our first guest this week is Farah Abdi. She is one of the amazing people that I met in Aachen this week. She actually won third prize in the Charlemagne Prize, which I think is super well deserved. It's for all her campaigning work that she's been doing, wandering around Europe and around the world, agitating for better rights for LGBT refugees.
Do you know what percentage of refugees who have arrived in the last few years roughly are LGBT?
You know, I have no idea. I imagine it's presumably about the same percentage as there are in the general population, no?
Yeah, which nobody knows.
Nobody knows. I always hear like 10%. But that could just be complete bullshit. I don't know where that number comes from.
Some people say 4%.
Some people say everyone on a spectrum.
Oh, hello.
Who even knows these days? In the refugee population, it might even be a little bit higher because I know we've had quite a few LGBT people coming from Chechnya in recent years, fleeing persecution in Russia. In Farah's case, it was because of her gender identity. She's just a really fascinating and inspiring person, I think. And I hope that you enjoy hearing from her.
Born in Somalia, grew up in Kenya, which is neighboring, and then left in 2012, fleeing fear of persecution due to my gender identity because I'm trans, crossing several sub-Saharan African countries, the huge Sahara Desert, Libya, the Mediterranean Sea, and then finally making it after 9 months by boat to Malta.
You were only 16 when you made this journey. It must have been quite dangerous making that journey as a really young trans person.
Well, at the time I was not openly trans, but still it was one of the hardest periods in my life. We had a lot of ups and downs. There were some days when, for example, we would celebrate, like every time we moved forward with the journey, it would be a celebration because we would be going closer to our goal. And then whenever we would be hindered because the police would catch us in the several countries that we were crossing illegally without documents, that would be a really low, bad day. So the journey was pretty much dangerous, lots of highs, lots of lows, full of hope, full of disappointment.
One day in 2012, you finally landed in Malta. What was that day like?
One of the best days of my life because I was like, oh my God, finally free. This horrible journey of 9 months is over. I'm going to start a new life. Like, it was the most hopeful day. It was like planning all your life to get married and then reaching the wedding day.
And I'm guessing it wasn't everything that you hoped for because these things never match up to our hopes. But what was your experience of your first few months, your first year living in Malta?
Their hopes were dashed immediately because Malta puts in prison asylum seekers who arrive by boat, which is actually illegal according to international law. Like, no state, which is a party of the 1951 Geneva Convention on Refugees, is supposed to put anybody in prison. But Malta does that against international law and also European law. The European Human Rights Court has found it illegal, but they still do it. And it's like running away from one prison and getting into another prison. But the difference is that this prison is in the European Union, the land of the free. And the only way to get out of that was the asylum interview. So it was the same day, being full of hope, arriving, ending the journey, and then realizing, no, it's not over because you have to go to prison and then get out using your interview, whether you get asylum or not.
And the interview went okay? Did it go quite smoothly or was it difficult?
For me, it was not difficult because at the time, like, I was pretty lucky because I arrived at a time when Malta was going through pretty much an ideological shift when it comes to LGBTQI issues. And it was like sort of stylish to be LGBTQI or to be trans. And it was funny because also the thing that had hurt me the most in my life, like growing up in a conservative family and hating myself and my identity, was for the first time in my life helping me to get out of a bad situation. So my transition helped me to get asylum.
Would you say it's a transition you're still going through?
Physical transition started in Germany. Mental and emotional transition started in Malta because it's a two-way process. It's not just the outer transition. You also have to transition from the inside.
And you became kind of a public figure quite quickly while you're in Malta. Tell me a bit about how that happened. You started a blog, I think.
Yeah, when I arrived in Malta, I noticed like a different set of challenges. In Kenya, I was fleeing discrimination due to my gender identity, but nobody discriminated against me because of my skin color. But then when I arrived in Malta, I noticed that, oh, skin color is a problem. Immigration background is a problem. But the difference between Kenya and Malta is that from Kenya, you could run away. From Malta, you cannot because of the stupid Dublin regulation. So you have to stay and fight it out. And that's why I was like, okay, if I'm going to be stuck here and stay, I might as well just do something with my voice. Because I speak perfect English. Malta is an English-speaking country, part of the Commonwealth. So maybe I can use that because other refugees don't speak very good English and they don't have a good educational background. So that's why I started the blog, just to speak about our stories and for the first time not have just the media telling our stories without involving us.
And what kind of things did you talk about in your blog?
It ranged from women issues to unaccompanied minors to detention in Malta, to the rise of xenophobia, to people finding it difficult to find work and integrate and social programs. Like, it was very broad.
And these days you're now based in Berlin. Big reason for that is because you find it a more friendly environment. What is it like being a trans person in Malta?
In Malta, my trans identity was never an issue. My black identity was. So it was like first when they thought I was a woman because I'm very passable until I speak or tell my story, they would be like, oh, what are you doing here? Like, this is not your country. And then once they hear my story, then they would say, oh, then you are welcome just because you're trans. And then I would be like, I ran away from Kenya because I wanted acceptance in all aspects of my life, not just one aspect. So I cannot live in a society whereby one aspect is accepted, but the other one is discriminated. because we are very multidimensional as human beings.
And these days you're in Berlin now. Do you find that a friendlier environment?
Oh my God, the best city in the world. To me, it's the best city in the world because I feel very free. Nobody asks me, where are you from, or you don't belong here. Or if they do it, it's just out of like friendly curiosity and not like, oh, you need to go away. So yeah, I've enjoyed the last 1.5 years.
And we're here in Aachen because you've just won the third prize in the Charlemagne Youth Prize. And it's for all of the work you've done since you've arrived in Europe. Tell us a bit about what you've been doing.
So the blog evolved into motivational speaking all over the world, whereby I get to bring attention to the challenges that refugees face, that minority groups within the refugee population face, like women and unaccompanied minors, the LGBTQ community, because within the vulnerability of refugees, there's even more vulnerability when you delve deeper. So speaking, writing, I also wrote an autobiography about my story and the story of other refugees. The book was launched in 24 countries. And basically a lot of activism, like telling the story again and again and again and again until we break down the wall and the barriers.
I think there's a tendency, certainly amongst some people in Europe, to see refugees as this kind of generic mass of people who all have the same problems, or they don't really think about it at all, probably. What do you think Europe could do better to look after minority groups within the refugee community?
I think just give them the support structures to integrate. Like, I don't like the word help, because help means offering something that can be taken away. So I prefer the word empower, like give them the support structures to be able to evolve into what they want to become. And then by then, they will integrate, they will pay taxes, they will live in the community, they will speak the languages, they would be normal citizens, you know?
That was the wonderful Farah Abdi. If you're interested in hearing her story, you can pick up a copy of her autobiography. It's called Never Arrive. We're going to hop over to Portugal right now for our Eurovision debrief. So it turns out our guest from last week, Daniel Gould, was totally on the money, predicting that Israel was going to put it off. This girl, Netta, with her fat positive feminist message and chicken dance.
Why didn't we put money on him, Katie?
I don't know, especially since we're really poor. We not only didn't win the Charlemagne Prize, but I've also lost my laptop, so oh. Yeah.
But one of my friends did actually put money on Israel after listening to our podcast last week, so he did win.
Really?
Although the odds weren't that exciting, I think, because Israel at that point was a bit of a favourite.
Well, I'm very happy for him.
But yeah, we're happy that Netta seems like an appropriate winner for the Eurovision Song Contest. She performed this song called Toy with the catchy chorus of I'm not your toy, stupid boy. It's been stuck in my head all night.
Have you been saying this to Thomas?
Well, yeah, I actually have.
So you're in Munich for the next few weeks, singing your own little heart out in a new opera. Did you find somewhere good to watch the show in the end?
Yeah, they don't really take Eurovision very seriously here in Munich, which I was really disappointed to.
Really?
Yeah, we tried to watch the semi-finals in some gay bars in town, because that's usually the go-to in Amsterdam and London whenever I've been there. And there was only one showing it, and they didn't have the volume up very loud. And so we did find a bar that was showing it with Graham Norton's commentary, which was nice, but it was all full of expats, and it was terrible sound quality and we could hardly hear anything.
Oh, no.
So I thought Australia were really good because I couldn't hear them, but apparently I now hear that Australia actually sounded terrible.
Yeah, it was terrible. So we were WhatsApping each other the whole way through, and you and Thomas were both like, yeah, go Australia, go Austria. You picked terrible songs.
No, Austria were great.
I don't understand. I was feeling very like mushy about Europe at the beginning of this show, but having watched Eurovision, I don't understand how people vote on this continent. I feel nothing in common with these people, because people picked terrible songs as the winners. But I'm sure all will become clear after speaking to our guests.
We are going to head over to speak to Matthew Kerr, who goes by the stage name of Magica. He has produced 2 platinum selling albums, won 3 French Grammys, the BBC Radio 3 Album of the Year, critics and press prizes at the San Remo Song Festival and the French Mercury Music Prize. But mainly we're speaking to him because he wrote his university dissertation about Eurovision.
Songs that I really liked were not the ones that the rest of Europe seemed to like. Can you explain why the songs that did well? Like, what makes a Eurovision hit?
A Eurovision hit is one that is memorable, because there are 26 songs in the grand final, and that's an awful lot of songs. So if you're not memorable, you will be forgotten, and if you're forgotten, nobody votes for you. I was very satisfied with the winner, and the song was really, really quirky and very different.
We love that chicken dance.
Chicken dance, chicken noises, you know, what more can you ask for?
Could we also talk about what was my personal favourite of the night, Sweden, which was a kind of, if you didn't see it, listeners, it was, I think, one of the most like radio-friendly pop hits, a bit kind of Justin Timberlake-y, and the production was amazing with this horizontal lighting show and this young, handsome man dancing in front of it. I was really surprised that where I was watching it in Germany in a gay bar, the German gays hated him. I wonder whether you have your ideas about why he ended up doing really badly with a televote.
That was a real shocker. It was a very kind of laid back song. It was a bit something a bit like Michael Jackson's Rock With You, or, you know, kind of Justin Timberlake in his kind of lighter, funkier moments, Bruno Mars a little bit. It could kind of pass you by if you're having your evening and you see a guy and it looked like a music video. That was...
It did, that's true.
A George Michael music video.
Yes, absolutely. And it was spectacularly done. I mean, to basically be performing a live music video with those cuts and the way that the lighting tubes like lit up.
It was amazing.
But two things. I think there's a bit of a backlash against Sweden. They're whatever the opposite of the underdog is. They are the overdogs. They always come to the contest with this spectacular staging. Usually a very handsome young guy, eyebrows plucked to, you know, and everything just totally a little bit plastic. And it's worked. The formula has worked incredibly well the past few years. And I think the public are getting a little tired of it.
I had my own theory that it was because the large gay community that watches it and queer community thought that he was a bit inauthentic in the way that he was like dancing in a kind of queer way. And then you watch his music video and you see that actually he's a totally heteronormative guy. And he was kind of putting it on for Eurovision.
It's a very fine line because I know a lot of the gay community really like Sweden when they send a handsome guy doing a modern pop song. There was something just a little bit cocky about him.
Yeah.
And he comes from this dynasty of pop singers as well in Sweden. His mom tried to represent Sweden several times and she's a bit of a kind of legend, although she never made it. Maybe that's the other thing. Maybe they're like, why did Pernilla not make it to Eurovision and yet her cocky son did? That's not fair. I don't know. There's some kind of baggage, some kind of gay baggage going on there, I think.
You've been involved in writing several songs for Eurovision that have made it into the national rounds of the competition. Is there a lot of pressure on you as a English language songwriter to write lyrics that are easy to understand for people that don't have English as a first language?
That's a very good question. I hadn't really thought of that. I think in my songwriting anyway, I like a strong title. I like a strong hook, even when I'm not thinking about people who have English as a second language. And to be fair, most people across Europe do speak pretty good English.
I had a thought yesterday. I was like, why don't we subtitle the non-English language songs? Is that like something that's called for ever?
This is a real hot potato, or une patate chaude. I was involved in the French entry this year. I wrote the English version of the French entry this year. There is an English version, but they did not perform it in English. I co-wrote it, I should say, with my amazing co-writer, Alison Azel, an American songwriter who's also been based in Paris. We were really proud of this English version. It was performed at a couple of preview parties, and I've had reports that people were in tears because the song itself is a very beautiful story of a little girl who was born on a migrant boat. She's called Mercy, and she's doing absolutely fine now, but she was fleeing a war. So there's a line in our translated version that says, "Here is where I was born with the name Mercy. Someone held out a hand giving life to me. For all the children lost to the cold, cold sea, I'll live 10,000 years. Je m'appelle Merci." That is powerful. I'm not bigging myself up here. It was the people, the guys who wrote the song who came up with this beautiful, beautiful idea for a song. And it's so moving. And every time I'd hear it, I'd cry. But if you don't speak French, you don't get it. And that's what happened. They were one of the favourites to win last night. They came 13th. I very gently, in my own way, suggested to the French artist that it might be interesting to have some kind of subtitling, or even if it were to be on stage, just have some of the words, some of the phrases maybe floating around on stage. It could have been interesting, but they chose not to. They chose to just stick with the French, and they came 13th. And I genuinely believe that if some of those lyrics had been communicated, it would have gone higher, because that's a beautiful story and a beautiful song.
And musically speaking, are there differences in the kind of songs that do well in different parts of the continent? Are there like some countries that are more likely to vote for the soppy ballads?
We've had such diverse winners over the past few years. We had a very brave, stripped back, jazz infused ballad in Portuguese that won last year. There aren't really any hard and fast rules. There's certainly a kind of beat that appeals more to Southern Europe and Eastern Europe because it would just remind them of their culture. There's a style of music in Eastern Europe called turbo folk. And if you're hitting that turbo folk rhythm, then you can bet that any fans of turbo folk are going to get on board. But then it's about quality. Is it well written? Is it well performed?
You mentioned the Portuguese winner from last year, Salvador Sobral, who performed last night in his typical, charming, unique way. But he kind of rubbed me up the wrong way again when he said he brought up again that he's bringing real music to Eurovision. Does that also rub you up the wrong way?
I think he's someone who maybe speaks before he thinks, or maybe he just doesn't care. He's been criticizing other songs. He's been kind of mouthing off and again talking about real music this and real music that. It doesn't mean anything really, because there are people in all over the continent, but particularly in Sweden, who love that kind of what he would call fast food, high processed firework pop music. It doesn't mean it's not real, it just means it's not to your taste.
Oh God, he really knows a lot about Eurovision. How do we keep finding these people who are so knowledgeable?
I kind of thought that we were Eurovision pros after watching it basically for the first time last year in a serious capacity, but we know nothing.
We really do know nothing. I was watching it last night with a French colleague who'd never seen it and was like, she was really surprised at how little noticeable national identity there was in most of the performances. Like, yeah, Moldova were wearing outfits that were made in the Moldovan flag, and a few were singing in their own languages, like France and Slovenia. But I'm really interested in it as like a brand of progressive nationalism in this kind of globalized way. Mm. It's a really unique progressive liberal strain of nationalism. And it still does seem to make people feel patriotic, because like the Germans in the room, even though they weren't interested in this fake Ed Sheeran German contestant, they still loved it whenever Germany got points.
I was kind of rooting for the British one, despite myself, especially when there was this stage invasion where she got her microphone taken away from her by this guy and she just carried on like a trooper, and I felt like really genuinely proud.
Yeah, she did really well. Well done, Siri.
Well done, Siri. Suri. Call her Siri.
She's not Siri.
Siri, why didn't you win Eurovision?
This week we have a happy ending from the courts. Unlike last week's ruling in the controversial gang rape case in Pamplona, this week the Spanish courts have made a decision that I can get behind. I am, of course, talking of the news of the ruling that a Spanish supermarket worker who had been fired for eating a pasty or an empanadilla was wrongly terminated and has to be either re-employed or given €19,000 in compensation.
She was terminated? Did you just use some, like, Euro-English there? You can't say that someone's been terminated.
Oh, can I not?
I don't think that's an English word. You've been living in the Netherlands too.
Wrongly terminated. Yes, you can.
Fired, surely. Or sacked.
You're terminated from a job.
I have never been terminated from a job. I don't get fired as much as you do.
A contract is terminated, brought to an end.
Yeah, but like, not the person. Anyway, sorry. Sorry to interrupt. Tell me the story.
Jesus, this is meant to be the happy ending. It's turned into a real grump fest. Anyway, the crux of the matter here was that she was secretly filmed with a hidden camera, which is against the law. You may think that shops should be allowed to fire a worker who eats a pasty without paying for it, but I like to think that if you've been working in a shop for 12 years, like she had been, then the supermarket should give you a bit of slack and allow you to occasionally eat a pasty.
Oh my God, if I worked in a supermarket, I would be taking pasties left, right and centre. Surely that's just the equivalent of like if you work in an office job, taking, you know, like a few pens every now and then.
Yeah, which is illegal. I hope you don't do that.
No, never. I would never do that. What are you talking about? What? No.
I don't know what the equivalent in the opera world is.
Three lozenges.
Three lozenges, or stealing one of the cool costumes we get to wear, which definitely we would get prosecuted for.
This is excellent news. I'm very happy for this woman.
Good. Yeah. She's unnamed, so I can't name check her, but I'm really happy for you, and I hope you take the money and run, frankly, because it sounds like they treated you pretty bad. Badly.
Go buy some more pasties. Well, I'm feeling a little bit deflated now that Eurovision is over, but we do have a new spectacle to look forward to this week. Your beloved Meghan Markle is getting married.
Oh, What day is it?
Saturday. They're getting married on Saturday.
Okay. We'll have to bring you news of the royal wedding next week.
We will live tweet the whole thing.
No.
Thank you very much to our guests this week, Farah Abdi and Magica.
If you don't follow us on Twitter yet, then, I mean, you're a lost cause, frankly, but it's not too late. We're going to be open to followers for another few days. Find us on Twitter at EuropeansPod. Instagram, we already mentioned, to see the pretty pictures of Katie and Emmanuel Macron. That's EuropeansPodcast. Or send us an email, EuropeansPodcast@gmail.com. We love getting emails.
And we're on Facebook, facebook.com/EuropeansPodcast.
We are unfashionably still on Facebook.
Whether or not you're a royalist, we hope you have a wonderful week in Europe and beyond.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Tschüss. So, Matthew, when you're not writing amazing Euro pop songs, you are the host of a great podcast about music called Music Meets, and you introduce your guests with a little bit of beatboxing each time. So I was wondering, could you please give us, in beatbox, Europeans Podcast?
Europeans Podcast, 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 Europeans Podcast. Europeans Podcast. Europeans Podcast.
Woo!
Yay! Thank you.